Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Hello, it's Norman Swan here with the Health Report. While the world has been watching bird flu in Asia with trepidation, out of the blue there's what seems to be a pig, bird and human influenza virus, probably stemming from Mexico. They say it's sensitive to the anti-flu drug Tamiflu, but on today's Health Report you'll hear about a cousin of this virus, which is Tamiflu resistant and is around in large numbers in the United States. And all this is happening just as we approach the influenza season in Australia, and you're no doubt being hounded to have a flu shot at work or from your GP. The question we'll be exploring later is just whether flu vaccine is as effective as it's touted. Some experts think the immunization's been overrated. And while everyone gets anxious about the prospect of a flu pandemic, and it's far from clear that'll happen with this new swine virus, did you know that about 500,000 people or so die of influenza every year from what's called seasonal flu? Recent research has exploded some myths about where new seasonal flu viruses emerge from and how they circulate around the world, and it helps to put the Mexican virus into context. Part of that story is the discovery over the last couple of years of resistance emerging to the popular anti-influenza drug oseltamivir. That's the proper name for Tamiflu. The resistance, as I said, is in an H1N1 flu virus, the same family as the one causing headaches around the world. Now, you might think it's due to doctors wildly prescribing oseltamivir, but research from France suggests the story's not so simple. Vincent Enouf is deputy director of the French National Influenza Centre's unit which covers northern France. Vincent is based at the Pasteur Institute in Paris and coordinates a large network of clinicians and pathologists who collect samples from people who seem to have the flu.
Last year and this year, there is a flu virus resistant of Tamiflu. This virus is the H1N1 virus.
So just to explain, when you say H and N, these are just different parts of the flu virus, which gives it a code.
H, it's for hemagglutinin, and N, it's for neuraminidase. And this human virus can be H1N1 or H3N2.
Now, or rated H5N1, H5. Which is the bird flu.
Yes, flu avian.
Now, we're not talking about avian flu in this case. In northern France, the H1N1 flu virus isn't the main one circulating. But even so, this is now the second year in a row they've found it resistant to Tamiflu. The question is why? And that's important to know because this flu virus is only a jet flight away from Australia. And there is a risk in the current situation of genetic interchange with pandemic virus. When resistance was first seen, many flu experts were extremely worried. Are French GPs throwing around anti-flu drugs and getting resistance as a result? Well, according to Vincent Enouf, French doctors aren't using oseltamivir very much. When the Pasteur Institute researchers studied this flu virus in the lab, they found it to be stronger, more resilient than non-mutated versions which don't carry the resistance gene. The extraordinary conclusion Vincent Enouf and his colleagues at the Pasteur Institute have come to is that this oseltamivir resistance is actually a spontaneous mutation in the virus, one that's occurred by sheer chance and is perpetuated because it accidentally provides an evolutionary advantage to the germ by giving it more fortitude. Fortunately, this resistant H1N1 virus is not any more illness-causing than its non-resistant cousins. It's just a bit beefier, but that doesn't mean it's risk-free.
It's very strong in the population of all viruses, and so you win.
It's a bit scary.
Yes. Last year, it's very new that H1N1 circulate. so resistant to Tamiflu. It's very new.
So can influenza viruses swap genes? I mean, the horror scenario would be H5N1 comes along. Can it pick up the mutation from H1N1 and acquire that gene?
It's possible, yes. You can imagine that in the same person, there is two viruses, H5N1 and H1N1 with the mutation. And there is a rearrangement between the two genomes, and the mutation of H1N1 can be used by the H5N1 to circulate in the population.
Vincent Enouf of l'Institut Pasteur in Paris, and I recorded that interview prior to the Mexican outbreak, but one would assume that the same resistance could occur. Now, the patterns of flu viruses and associated medical practice around the world actually support the French theory of spontaneous mutations. You see, this oseltamivir, or Tamiflu-resistant H1N1 virus, doesn't just occur in France. It's been seen around the world. In Norway, for instance, where doctors don't use oseltamivir much at all, 70% of H1N1 influenza is Tamiflu-resistant. Whereas in Japan, where doctors dole out Tamiflu like M&Ms, only 3% of H1N1 viruses are resistant. In the United States, they're seeing resistance too, and predict that this year there will be even more than last year. The fear will be that the resistance gene finds its way to the swine virus. So how do the experts get a handle on this to help understand what's going on? Well, it's important to know where new seasonal flu viruses come from and how they circulate globally. Seasonal flu is what occurs year in, year out, and is different from the feared pandemic flu. The Mexican outbreak, reported, is not a seasonal flu, it's a potential pandemic flu. Anyway, remarkable advances have occurred in recent years in understanding the process of seasonal flu spread. Someone who's been working with an international team on flu virus migration and exploding a few myths along the way is Dr. Colin Russell, who's head of epidemiology at the Centre for Pathogen Evolution at the University of Cambridge in the UK.
The WHO, Global Influenza Surveillance Network, collects influenza viruses from over 100 countries around the world. And one of the questions has been, how do influenza viruses migrate around the world? So in collaboration with the WHO Global Influenza Surveillance Network, we looked at all of the data that was collected between 2002 and 2007.
In a real-time sense?
Yes, the data is collected in real time, and it gives us an opportunity to watch virus evolution occur. So viruses are collected and the data is assimilated into reports every 6 months to judge which viruses should go into the vaccine for the upcoming influenza season. So this decision is made twice per year, once for the Northern Hemisphere and once for the Southern Hemisphere.
So you're trying to pick the rogues.
It's not necessarily just the rogues. We're also interested in the most representative viruses. So if we're trying to pick the vaccine that's going to work best in 1 year's time, we have to anticipate how the virus might change and which viruses would be the best to put into the vaccine in terms of conferring general protection for the population.
So using a football context, you've got to move into the open space where the pass is going to come.
Exactly.
What studies have you done and what have you found?
The primary study that we've been working on recently is looking at how viruses migrate around the world. Because we have to make this decision 1 year in advance of when the vaccine is actually going to be used, and because influenza viruses can evolve so quickly, it'd be good to know what region of the world, if we could, focus on one particular region to know where those viruses were going to be coming from, so we can maybe get a heads up on where those viruses are going to be coming from next.
Don't we already know that? That it's Asia and the maelstrom of ducks and geese and other bird life and human life in Asia?
Well, there's two separate issues there. So one, when we think about pandemic viruses, for example, and when we hear all the news about bird flu and H5N1, that sort of thing, it's likely that the human-animal interface in Asia is responsible for those cross-species transmission where humans are getting sick with bird flu. But when it comes to seasonal flu, the mechanisms by which the viruses have moved around the world have been largely unknown. Now, Asia...
So to explain here, what we're talking about here is it's two different things.
Yes.
One is the potential for pandemic flu, which is going to kill squillions of people. And where's that going to come from?
Maybe. There's actually been three pandemics in the last century. There was one in 1918, but there were also one in 1957 and one in 1968. Now, the one in 1918 is, of course, the sort of situation that everyone's really afraid of. But then there were also ones in 1957 and 1968, which killed many, many fewer people than the one in 1918 and were only 2 to 3 times worse than normal seasonal flu. So within your average season, worldwide, approximately 500,000 people die of influenza each year. Now, this is associated with 5 to 10% of the world's population being infected. So we're literally looking, you know, at approximately 600 million cases of flu worldwide per year. This results in about 500,000 deaths. If we think about the last two pandemics being only 2 to 3 times worse than that, as compared to the number of people that died in 1918, a pandemic doesn't necessarily have to be the end of the world.
Okay, but what we're talking about is common or garden flu that affects us each year.
Yes, we're talking about seasonal flu.
So what have you found?
There have been a number of hypotheses over the last 60 years which have accounted for how viruses move around the world. One of the dominant hypotheses was that viruses move back and forth between the northern and southern hemispheres because flu is a wintertime disease, and it's winter in the northern hemisphere and summertime in the southern hemisphere. And then the viruses could move back and forth between the hemispheres owing to the differences in the timing of summer. An equally popular hypothesis was that influenza viruses come out of the tropics each year because there is no winter in the tropics, so the viruses could circulate year-round and then move into the temperate regions whenever the seasonal factors were appropriate. Yet another hypothesis, and this just goes to show the sort of lack of understanding that there was in the field, is that maybe influenza viruses just hang out locally after an epidemic is over, and then they come back when wintertime comes around again. So
spontaneous combustion in local areas.
Well, sort of something like that. You know, it passes at some low level from individual to individual between epidemics, and then it really takes off when everyone is immunocompromised because it's so cold outside, for example. And then yet another hypothesis is that maybe influenza viruses came out of China. But there had not previously been enough evidence to know which one of those hypotheses was correct.
So what did you do?
In collaboration with the WHO Global Influenza Surveillance Network, we looked at all of the data collected from 2002 to 2007. So this was about 13,000 influenza viruses from around the world. And using a combination of genetic analyses, looking at the DNA code of these viruses, and antigenic analysis, actually looking at the proteins on the surface of the virus.
Those are the proteins to which the immune system reacts.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the hemagglutinin protein. We were able to determine that influenza viruses come from East and Southeast Asia as a region, not just China, but the entire region, into the rest of the world each year. And this was big because the other thing that we were able to show was that influenza viruses don't persist locally in between epidemics. And it's not that they're coming out of the tropics each year, and they're not bouncing back and forth between the northern and southern hemispheres, but rather they literally come from Asia each and every year.
So this is like birds migrating.
Well, it's somewhat like birds migrating. The other interesting aspect of this, it's not just that they come from Asia, but that viruses don't persist in any one particular city or country in Asia all the time. Rather, influenza viruses circulate continuously in Asia by passing from country to country, from epidemic to epidemic, like runners passing a baton in a relay race. But it's a relay race that doesn't end. And so one of the important things about Asia in this context is that if we think about the timing of flu epidemics in Australia and New Zealand, or in North America, for example, they all happen right around the same time. It's a wintertime disease. In the temperate parts of Asia, the same situation is true. Basically, we have epidemics in the northern hemisphere winter. But when we get into tropical countries, the situation is slightly different. If we think about someplace like Thailand or Malaysia, they don't really have a wintertime. And this led to a lot of confusion for a long time that maybe influenza viruses circulate there all the time because there is no winter. But one of the things that we had seen in the data that other people had noticed as well is that influenza in tropical countries, in particular in tropical East and Southeast Asia, tends to happen during the rainy season. Now, there's a lot of variability in the rainy season. So whereas in Australia and New Zealand, all of the epidemics occur at basically the same time because winter happens at the same time, the variability in the timing of winter relative to the timing of rainy seasons in different parts of the continent results in there being epidemics at different times of year. So a good example of this is Bangkok and Kuala Lumpur. Though they're only about 1,000 miles apart, they have their epidemics at completely different times of year. Bangkok has its epidemic during the Northern Hemisphere summer, and Kuala Lumpur has its epidemic during the Northern Hemisphere winter. And so it's these sorts of differences in this close geographic proximity that allows the viruses to pass from epidemic to epidemic and continually circulate in East and Southeast Asia.
In a sense, that creates the whirlpool for the generation of new viruses.
Essentially, yes. So what we see is that viruses circulate continuously in East and Southeast Asia by passing from country to country, and then they're continuously showered out into the rest of the world.
At random?
Presumably at random. So,
because I thought there was like a southern oscillation, as they would say in climatic terms, that they came to the southern hemisphere and then southern hemisphere viruses appeared in the northern hemisphere the next season.
Exactly. So this is one of the hypotheses that you're getting at here, that viruses migrate back and forth between the northern and southern hemispheres because of the differences in the timing of the seasons.
And you're saying that doesn't happen?
No. One of the things that we see is that viruses migrate out of East and Southeast Asia all of the time. Presumably they're being carried by unwitting passengers on civil transport. And they get taken to Australia, New Zealand, to North America, and to Europe. This happens all of the time. And so you see viruses isolated year-round in any place where surveillance is really strong. But one of the things that we showed in looking at all of this global data was that viruses that you see in between epidemics in temperate regions of the world aren't related to viruses in the previous epidemic.
Epidemic or season?
Epidemic, influenza season. You can almost use these terms interchangeably. And in all of the cases for which there was enough data to check, that person who was infected, who had presented themselves and been swabbed to get virologically confirmed data, had either recently been to Asia or had been connected to someone who had just come back from Asia. So viruses leave Asia all of the time, and they take off in temperate regions when the seasonal factors are appropriate. But then when the epidemic is over in that place, in whatever temperate region, those viruses just die. So basically, regions outside of East and Southeast Asia are sort of an evolutionary graveyard. After viruses go to Australia and New Zealand, there's nowhere else for them to go. They die. When the viruses go to Europe and North America, though, they don't go back to Asia, as do the viruses from Australia and New Zealand. But when viruses go to North America, they actually have one further place that they can go. South America and Asia are not well connected to each other at all. It's very difficult to get on a plane in Tokyo and end up anywhere in South America without changing planes at least once. And it's not that we don't have planes that could fly that far. It's a market-driven economy. If there were a demand, those flights would exist.
So what you're saying is South America is relatively isolated apart from North America?
South America is really isolated apart from North America and Europe, at least in terms of its connectivity to Asia. And so one of the things that we see is that viruses tend to appear later in South America than they do in North America or in Europe. And actually, when we look at the genetic relatedness of the viruses, we see that all viruses are originating in East and Southeast Asia, but that the viruses in South America are sort of passed down from these viruses that originated in Asia and then went to Europe and North America and then later appeared in South America.
And what's the time difference then to South America? Because the risk is that if you're in Buenos Aires, you get a vaccine too late. In other words, you get next year's vaccine when last year's vaccine is actually what you needed.
Well, that's a very good point. Basically, we see that new viruses appear in East and Southeast Asia about 6 to 9 months before they appear in Europe, North America, and Australia and New Zealand. And then it's approximately another 6 months before they appear in South America. So we do have this approximately 1 year lead time. But the nice thing that that does for South America is that for places that are in the temperate regions of South America, where we would expect epidemics to happen in the southern hemisphere winter, they should be well protected by whichever vaccine is being recommended for the other portions of the southern hemisphere.
Because they benefit from other people's mistakes.
It's one way to look at it. Now, the other nice thing is that there's a good deal of variability in the timing of epidemics in South America. And so places in the northern portion of South America, particularly in northern Brazil, epidemics tend to occur earlier in northern Brazil than they do in places like Australia and New Zealand. And so that gives them the option to take the northern hemisphere vaccine strain recommendation or the southern hemisphere vaccine strain recommendation. Either one of them could be good, and they can decide which one is most appropriate for them.
So knowing that East Asia is where it's being generated, does that help you identify the vaccine, or they've got to kind of, they're producing, sharing so many viruses, you've actually got to wait until they prove themselves in the North American or Southern Hemisphere environment?
There's a lot of factors that go into the vaccine strain selection decision. But one of the situations that can arise and could be greatly facilitated by understanding where viruses are coming from. For example, if we see that there's a new variant of virus emerging in East and Southeast Asia, for example, but we also see that there's a slightly different variant that's currently in North America, we know that the viruses that are in North America are unlikely to be the viruses that cause the next epidemic in North America the following season. And it's much more likely that the viruses that are in East and Southeast Asia will be the ones that cause the epidemic in North America the following year. And so in that sense, it gives us the opportunity to really focus on surveillance efforts in places like East and Southeast Asia, because we know that that's where the next viruses are likely to be coming from. And so we don't get distracted by what's happening so much in the rest of the world. Now, it's important to know what's going on elsewhere, because it's possible that in the future, the system could change. New viruses could appear somewhere other than Southeast Asia and then spread around the world. And so we need to remain vigilant worldwide. But if it came down to deciding between a strain that was in South America versus a strain that was in Asia, that decision becomes a lot more clear, owing to all of these past patterns that we've seen where new viruses tend to come from Asia.
And just going back to the original dichotomy between pandemic flu and seasonal flu, does this research give you any insight into pandemic flu?
This particular research, no. Pandemic flu is sufficiently more complicated, and the real factors that will ultimately lead to an animal virus becoming human and transmitting well in humans and then spreading worldwide remain poorly understood.
But so pandemic flu could spread quite differently from the seasonal variation?
Very much so, yes. Now, one thing that will be really interesting to see is that after a pandemic is over, we're left with years and years and years of seasonal flu. Every time we have a pandemic, the pandemic viruses replace all of the seasonal flu viruses that came before, and then those become the seasonal flu viruses until the next pandemic happens. So it could be different, but it would be interesting to see if the seasonal patterns change after the emergence of a new pandemic virus.
Colin Russell is head of epidemiology at the Centre for Pathogen Evolution at the University of Cambridge in the UK. And if you think the Mexican outbreak in the news contradicts what Colin just said, it actually doesn't, as he implied. This is a reassortment of genes resulting in a combined pig, bird and human virus, which is the kind of genetic change, as he implied, that one day will lead to a pandemic. And those viruses don't follow the seasonal rules. And you're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National. Well, they go to all this effort trying to work out which will be this year's viruses for the flu vaccine, and there's widespread encouragement of people, especially the elderly, to have the flu shots before winter hits. But you might be surprised to hear there's debate about whether the flu vaccine is actually a good public health investment. Research from Seattle suggests the population benefits in terms of preventing death and pneumonia are so small they're hard to measure. Dr. Lisa Jackson is a senior investigator at the Group Health Center for Health Studies in Seattle.
Influenza vaccine has been used routinely in seniors in the United States since the 1980s, and there has been a desire to know what benefit is being achieved by this vaccination program that now has rates each year of around 70% of seniors receiving the vaccine.
Seniors being described as people over 65.
Yes, sorry. And the difficulties are that we don't really test seniors to find out if they have influenza infection or not. So then you're left looking at more non-specific outcomes, whether someone died or not, and then whether they were hospitalized with a diagnosis or pneumonia. There have been multiple studies that have used administrative data systems such as exist for health maintenance organizations in the United States, where all of the members have their vaccinations recorded and their diagnoses and death information, and all universally showing extremely apparent large benefits of the vaccine, meaning that the seniors who received the vaccines had much lower risks of dying during winter months and also being hospitalized with a diagnosis code for pneumonia. So this large body of evidence was interpreted as meaning that we're doing a lot of good with the influenza vaccine. How I came into it was that it's actually too good to be true, because the studies were reporting that the risk of death was half as much in vaccinated seniors as in unvaccinated seniors, meaning that of all deaths that would occur in the winter in the absence of vaccination, you're preventing half of them by giving the vaccine. But influenza itself doesn't cause nearly that higher proportion of winter deaths. So it's impossible for the vaccine to do more good than the harm caused by influenza. In other words, all the vaccine can do is prevent someone from getting influenza.
It's not some magical live-long recipe.
So there was sort of a fundamental logical problem with these results that surprisingly had not really been questioned. The pneumonia hospitalization results were less dramatic. The risk of pneumonia hospitalization was usually reduced around 20 or 30%. And so in parallel with this, you know, we've known from studies of other types of interventions that it's very dangerous to just compare people who get an intervention, especially a preventive intervention like hormone replacement therapy, for example, or people who take vitamins, and just simply compare them with other people, because there's many differences potentially between the two groups other than the thing that you're looking at.
And just to clarify, what we're talking about here is not a randomized trial. It's observing large groups of people and comparing them. And with hormone replacement therapy, which we've talked a lot about on the Health Report, women were taking that by and large based on observational studies rather than randomized trials. And when the randomized trial was done, it was found to be harmful.
Yes, people don't randomize themselves very well. People that do the things they're supposed to do tend to have a lot of other healthy behaviors and tend not to be as ill as other people. So anyway, if you just compare large groups, you find significant differences, which in the case of an influenza vaccine were said to be due to the actual vaccine effect, but which I thought could be due to these inherent health differences between the people who choose to receive the vaccine and the people who, for whatever reason, do not.
There's something about people who put themselves forward for influenza immunization.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you consider seniors, which is the group studied in nearly all these studies. You're looking at a very large age range, 65 to 105, potentially. You're looking at people who are extremely healthy, you know, mountain biking and stuff like that, and you're looking at people who are literally in the terminal stages of life. So you just got this vast difference.
So how did you study it?
So what we chose to say then that if there is something that's truly happening because someone gets influenza vaccine, you should only see that effect when there's actually influenza around. During periods of time, like, say, in the fall or during the late spring and summer, when influenza is not circulating in North America, then there should not be any difference in people who got the vaccine because the vaccine can't really be doing anything. So we set up analyses where we started looking at people in the fall. We tracked when everyone received the vaccine or not, and we defined periods of time being some before influenza season, some during influenza season, some after, and we did this over a 10-year period. And what we found is that when you look before influenza season, you see that the vaccinated people have a risk of death that's 60% less than the unvaccinated people. Then during influenza season, it's about 50% less, which is exactly what all the other studies have shown that looked only during influenza season. And then after influenza season, you see about a 30% lower risk of death. But the important thing is that in periods of time in which there's no influenza circulating, you still see very large differences in risk of death between the people who choose to get the vaccine and those who don't. So that, I think, proves that there are important inherent differences between those two groups.
And that's the risk of death rather than the risk of pneumonia.
That is the risk of death. However, we did the same thing for the risk of pneumonia hospitalizations and saw pretty much the same thing, that the largest difference, the greatest apparent reduction in risk of death in vaccinated people is in the period of time before influenza season starts.
So what's your conclusion from this?
Well, clearly, if you can see a larger benefit during a time in which there should be no benefit, then that means that inherent health differences in the two groups can explain all of what you're seeing during the winter influenza season months.
So there's no effect?
Well, if there was a real effect, especially against death, I think what you have to keep in mind is it would be very small because influenza causes maybe 5% of winter deaths. Maybe the vaccine would prevent about half of those, you know, something like that. So now you're looking at a 2.5% difference. That could be washed out by this huge problem with the bias. There's much more than one thing going on. One thing that might be happening is that people who are extremely seriously ill and who are expected not to survive more than a couple weeks or months, for them, the flu vaccine is not a very high health priority. And it doesn't take a very large group like that to create a huge bias in the results.
It seems extraordinary that we've implemented a vaccination program without a large randomized trial to prove on a public health basis that it works.
I would agree. The influenza vaccines were introduced into the licensing system in the U.S. and other places at a different time than now. Now you have to prove that the vaccine does work in the population for whom it's indicated before it's licensed. And there have been many trials in healthy adults of influenza vaccine. So it does work in some people. The question is, does it work in the people who are experiencing the greatest risk of dying or being hospitalized during flu season? And that group is the oldest old and people with serious underlying health conditions, you know, heart and lung disease, for example. And that group has never been evaluated in a randomized trial.
So one statistic which you often hear now in evidence-based medicine is the number needed to treat, in this case, number needed to immunize to save a life or save a pneumonia. We haven't a clue what that is. It could be 10,000, 100,000, 100. We don't know.
That's true, although some of the studies that have used the method that I'm discrediting, the simple comparison method, have concluded that you need a very small number needed to treat to prevent one death because, of course, the results apparently indicate such a large benefit. But you're right. I mean, based on actual hard evidence, we really don't have any way to judge that. And that also impacts the cost-benefit analyses, which you often hear of giving flu vaccine to seniors saves money. But again, those estimates are based on, I think, wildly inflated ideas of what the true benefit is.
And this doesn't tell you anything about the growing trend to immunize people in the workplace.
Yeah, that's a different question. Although we have a much larger solid body of evidence that if you give influenza vaccine to healthy people, you reduce their risk of getting influenza if the vaccines match to the circulating strains. I mean, there have been some studies in the workplace in which workers have been randomized to influenza vaccine or not, and the results are variable because influenza is very variable. There may not be a good match or there may not be much influenza around, in which case you're not going to see a lot of benefit from immunizing workers in a given year. You know, maybe across 10 years, on average, you will see some reduction in workplace absenteeism, but you can't count on it in any given year for sure.
And if you're 70 years old and listening to this and we are
about to enter the flu season in Australia. What's the message for you as a 70-year-old?
Well, I mean, on an individual basis, there's not much downside. I mean, you have to go and get the shot, but with flu vaccine, there's not much of a risk side to it for an individual, and there's the possibility of benefit.
Dr. Lisa Jackson is a senior investigator at the Group Health Center for Health Studies in Seattle. I'm Norman Swan, and you've been listening to The Health Report. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Dr. Norman Swan of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's Health Report. This program was originally aired on April 27th on the Australian Broadcasting Network and is available on podcast, as are all the Health Report broadcasts, at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's website. And now, in advance of the news, a little boogie with Omar and Howlers, Hoodoo Ball.
Hang on.
And now for a review of the news of the last couple of weeks. We remind you that these are excerpts from the articles. To review the actual text of the articles, you have to go to the media that we mention on the show. From the Globe and Mail on Friday, July the 24th, columnist Gary Mason, Mounties have no choice but to comply. In his report made public, Mr. Braidwood came down precisely where I thought he would. All police should be able to continue using tasers, but under many more restrictions, and that makes sense. At the end of the day, tasering people who are a danger is often a better alternative to shooting them. But Mr. Braidwood wants a new threshold established for when officers can pull out their conducted energy weapons. The RCMP recently instituted new guidelines that state an officer can use a stun gun only when someone is a threat to officer or public safety or is exhibiting assaultive behavior. Those parameters are too broad and open to interpretation, according to Mr. Braidwood, whose recommendations stem from the RCMP taser-related death of Robert Zakansky in October 2007. Mr. Braidwood wants new policies in place that insist the taser not be used unless the subject is causing bodily harm or the officer is satisfied on reasonable grounds that the subject's behavior will imminently cause bodily harm. But the inquiry head goes further. Even then, an officer should not deploy the weapon unless satisfied on reasonable grounds that no lesser force option would be effective and that de-escalation and or crisis intervention techniques would not be effective. Under those principles, it would have been much harder for the officers involved in the Zakansky incident to justify their actions. But as Braidwood notes, the RCMP is a federal force and not subject to BC statutes. It's answerable to Ottawa only, even though BC residents pay the Mounties' salaries here. In other words, the force doesn't have to listen to a thing Mr. Braidwood has to say if it doesn't want to. But Mr. Braidwood, brilliant man that he is, has given the BC government a way around the problem. That is, if the RCMP doesn't voluntarily agree to implement the recommendations. You see, the RCMP's contract with the province is up in 2012. Mr. Braidwood has suggested the government insists the Mounties agree to implement all of the Commission's recommendations regarding tasers as a condition of renewing its public agreements with the province. BC Solicitor General Cash Heed said he has sent an order to the RCMP that it comply with the recommendations, certainly a rare display of nerve by this government in its dealing with the force. I guess we'll see what happens. RCMP management in BC told me they are going to take some time to digest the Braidwood report before commenting on the recommendations and deciding whether they'll adopt all of them in BC and or across the country. Contrary to some reports, the RCMP has not promised to implement all the recommendations, E-Division Commander Gary Bass told me yesterday. But my feeling is the Mounties will, because they really have no choice. There is a great swell of public opinion rising against them, and my guess is that public opinion will be solidly behind the many good suggestions made in Mr. Braidwood's report. I think the RCMP should just surrender on this one. Also from the Globe and Mail recently, I have no date, Don Walton in Calgary wrote, "Police in Alberta, including the RCMP, must adhere to new rules about when they can deploy tasers or face losing the weapons altogether, under government guidelines released yesterday. The 11 pages of regulations also say it is appropriate to use conducted energy weapons, or CEWs, only when there is a real likelihood of injury to the officer, subject, or bystanders." Fred Lindsay, Alberta Solicitor General and Minister of Public Security, said that while a suspect who is running away isn't a reasonable threat, someone in handcuffs or other restraints could still kick or bite. "Obviously, this tool has been controversial," he told CHQR Radio in Calgary. "Public confidence is important in anything that the police do, and this is just one example where I believe clear, concise guidelines will promote public confidence." Under the new rules, police must tell the government each time a taser is used, so an assessment can be done. If the use is deemed to have been inappropriate, the province could issue warnings, take away a police force's weapons, or suspend individual officers, Mr. Lindsay said. Alberta will also test the devices annually and before any new ones are put into service to make sure they meet the manufacturer's specifications. In April, dozens of tasers in use in Alberta were pulled when independent tests showed they didn't work properly. RCMP Corporal Wayne Oakes said Mounties in Alberta welcome the new rules, adding that they are consistent with RCMP policy and enhance public trust. Acting Superintendent Ray Robitaille said the Calgary Police Service is already following the guidelines. And from a Globe and Mail article, again no date, Braidwood means a whole new start. Canada has a state-of-the-art manual that says the taser can kill, and its use by police forces need to be severely limited, but have provinces noticed the silence of most of them on last week's 556-page Braidwood report has been, well, stunning. Police guidelines in much of Canada allow for tasers to be used at very low levels of threat, even in some jurisdictions when people who are not dangerous are merely walking away from an officer, even a Vancouver Transit officer. Mr. Braidwood would limit their use to truly dangerous, though not life-threatening, situations. The Braidwood recommendation should also be embraced by the RCMP. The National Police Force appears to have accepted them for its BC detachments, but has yet to say whether it does so for the rest of the country. It would be unconscionable if most provinces sat on their hands and pretended Mr. Braidwood's report is relevant only to BC. The truths he uncovered apply everywhere, even if his jurisdiction was limited to BC. If the taser can kill in BC, it can kill in New Brunswick or Ontario. Its use should be drastically curtailed everywhere. From the Hamilton Spectator, Thursday, July 30th, 2009, by Tanya Talaga. Peterborough resident John Wood wants to know why his family was suddenly cut off from a government benefit to help them pay for his daughter's prohibitively high medical expenses. Her health costs are a financial struggle for the family. Special dietary requirements and drugs can cost upwards of $2,000 a month. Private insurance only goes so far. In April, Wood, who works for PepsiCo Foods Canada, says the family suddenly lost the $410 monthly check they received under the Assistance for Children with Severe Disabilities, or ACSD program, an income-based program intended to help low- to moderate-income families. The cutoff for eligibility for a family of four is $62,641. The benefit was also based on the child's severity of illness and the extraordinary expenses faced by the family. But that doesn't seem to apply anymore, Wood said. The Liberals have increased spending on the program from $63 million to $90 million, and as a result, 5,000 more disabled children are being helped. This is a program we continue to invest in, said Deb Matthews, Minister of Children and Youth Services. New Democratic leader Andrea Horvath said both she and the ombudsman, Andre Marin, still receive calls from parents who say they have been told in order to get financial support, they should consider giving up custodial rights of their kids to the Crown. Quote, this is absolutely cruel, unacceptable, and unbelievable it still happens in this province, Horvath said yesterday. The ministry refuses to change its policies, so instead the ombudsman has to step in to help families on a case-by-case basis. The government should acknowledge their programs need to be updated and overhauled. Horvath noted inflation has risen 27% in the last 12 years, yet the income limit has remained virtually unchanged since the ACSD's program's inception in 1997. And from the Globe and Mail, Kirk Macon, Justice Reporter. Again, no date on this, but it's recent. Fetal alcohol victims face discrimination. Law professor says fetal alcohol spectrum disorder sufferers unfairly treated by courts. In an article scheduled for publication, University of Toronto law professor Kent Roach argues that the prosecution and imprisonment of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder victims flies in the face of a justice system predicated on punishing only those who intentionally break the law or are legally at fault for their actions. Quote, the cognitive deficits associated with FASD present a fundamental challenge to the standard assumptions of the Canadian criminal justice system, he said. Victims of the disorder suffer permanent brain damage because of prenatal alcohol exposure. Professor Roach said that the syndrome deprives them of conventional free will and a sense of individual responsibility. It also leaves them prone to memory loss and impulsivity, and they are easily influenced by others. Professor Roach said that those with the syndrome get into considerably more trouble, yet typically refuse the help of legal counsel upon arrest and often give false confessions. One of the dangers of suggestibility of some people with FASD is that they may be persuaded to provide false confessions to the police, Professor Roach said. He said that his This trait becomes even more hazardous in light of recent Supreme Court of Canada decisions that permit police to be, quote, persistent and suggestive during interrogations. In some severe cases, defenses are likely being ignored, Professor Roach added in an interview. In many other cases, inappropriate sentences are being applied. Professor Roach recommended that judges seriously consider whether FAS victims ought to be found unfit to stand trial. Hamilton Spectator, Saturday, July 25th, 2009. Reproduced from The Economist. Is the patient in a coma or not? Worrying study questions what doctors actually see. Labels matter. Indeed, they can be the difference between life and death. Someone lying in a hospital bed labeled as in a minimally conscious state will be kept on life support indefinitely. If the label says vegetative state, however, that life support could be turned off anytime. A layman might not be able to tell the difference, but a doctor can. Or can he? A worrying study just published in Biomed Central Neurology by Carolyn Schnakers, Stephen Lorries, and their colleagues at the University of Liège Coma Science Group suggests that perhaps he cannot, or perhaps worse, that he prefers to use his intuition rather than the latest diagnostic techniques to tell the difference. As a result, many people may be at risk of early termination, even when they show flickering signs that their consciousness has not departed entirely. Vegetative patients are those who show no signs of awareness whatever, and in many countries, courts can consider petitions to withdraw their food and water, allowing them to die, as in happened in a case of a blaze of publicity in the case of Terry Schiavo in Florida a few years ago, and for their organs to be removed for transplantation. Patients who do show signs of awareness, those who are able to obey a command to blink or track a moving object with their eyes, for example, are by definition not vegetative and are spared this fate. There is some evidence that unlike those in a vegetative state, these patients feel pain. Efforts are made to ease their suffering and to rehabilitate them. Earlier this decade, two new tools became available, so things might have been expected to get better. One of the novel tools was a new diagnostic category, the minimally conscious state. This describes patients who are a shade better off than those in a vegetative state. The other new tool was the JFK Coma Recovery Scale. This consists of more than 20 clinical tests and is reckoned not only to enable doctors to distinguish patients in a vegetative state from those with minimal consciousness, but also to identify those who were previously in a minimally conscious state but have emerged from it. It's widely accepted as giving an accurate diagnosis of these conditions, but is it being adhered to? Lorries' measured conclusion is that neurologists do not like their skills to be replaced or upstaged by a scale. It's all very disturbing. Admittedly, the Liège study is but a single piece of research, but if it were duplicated elsewhere, that would raise questions about how some of the most vulnerable patients in the medical system are being treated and how seriously some doctors take the tools that science works hard to deliver to them. The Spectator again from the Associated Press with files from the Canadian Press. Health news. Arthritis drugs pose risk of cancer to kids. FDA. U.S. federal regulators added stronger warnings to a group of best-selling drugs used to treat arthritis and other inflammatory diseases, saying they can increase the risk of cancer in children and adolescents. After more than a year of review, Food and Drug Administration scientists said the drugs appear to increase the risk of cancer after they are used beyond 2.5 years. The agency studied several dozen reports of cancer in children taking the drugs, some of which were fatal. Half of the cases were lymphomas, a cancer that attacks the immune system. Health Canada said new information would be made public as soon as it is available, and in the meantime, patients taking the drugs should contact their physicians or pharmacists if they have questions. The FDA will bolster the black box warning on the 5 drugs sold in the U.S., including Abbott Laboratories' Humira, Johnson & Johnson's Remicade and Simponi, and Enbrel, which is co-marketed by Amgen Incorporated and Wyeth. All products are multi-billion dollar sellers. The drugs are known as tumor necrosis factor blockers and are prescribed to children with rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disorder, and Crohn's disease. and from the Globe and Mail again, by Roy Romanow, How to Make Recovery Quicker and Less Painful for Those Hurting Most. The Bank of Canada recently declared an end to the recession. There's a world of difference, however, between an end to economic decline as measured by GDP and a real recovery as felt by Canadians. A recently released report, The Economic Crisis Through the Lens of Economic Well-being, points out that in each of the past two recessions, lower and middle income families experienced much larger losses of income proportionately than higher income households. In the 1982-83 recession, the market income of the bottom 20% of households dropped by 38%, while the top 20% of households lost just 3%. In the 1990-93 recession, the bottom 20% lost 74% of income, compared to 5.1% for the top 20%. This means that whether the recession ends now or later, recovery will be longer and slower for low- and middle-income households. That change shouldn't surprise anyone, as it coincided with significant cuts to EI coverage and benefits, the safety net designed to cushion Canadians from the worst effects of economic downturn. Even though the unemployment rate started falling in 1994, poverty kept rising until 1997, 3 years later. EI is even weaker now than it was in the 1991 recession, and the impact of those cuts has been magnified by a weakening of welfare benefits in most parts of Canada. To put it bluntly, it is much more difficult to avoid becoming poor in a weakening economy in Canada today than it used to be, and it is much more difficult to climb out of poverty than it used to be. The report suggests that unemployment will continue to climb to 10% in 2010, with the poverty rate rising to more than 13%, a level our country hasn't seen since 1998. From a public policy perspective, there are two priorities for government action. First, governments must continue to offset the shortfall in private sector spending that prevents our economy from operating at full capacity. This is no time to become complacent and assume that just because GDP may be picking up a little, the market economy will take care of everything. It was that kind of thinking that got us into trouble in the first place. Second, since recessions primarily hit the unemployed hardest and longest, it's vital that governments support individual Canadians who lose their jobs through income supplement and retraining programs that meet their needs. The system we now have simply isn't up to the task, and fixing it is going to require more than tinkering. Canada has already acted by lowering interest rates and injecting massive stimulus into the economy to ensure a shallower and shorter recession than most have predicted. It must now demonstrate that it has also learned how to make the recovery quicker and less painful for those who are hurting the most. That's it for Disrespect this week. Going out with Omar and the Howlers. That's Just My Life. See you back next week.
It's a long way from Pittsburgh down to Knoxville, Tennessee, but I'm in it for the long haul, and that's all right with me. Roadhouse, daylight's burning up the miles, the blacktop goes forever. I was born a highway child. It's always people waiting to have a real good time, till it's getting the big wheel rolling
what you get. To me, it's not a game. It's not for everybody, but it's the life I choose. I got gypsy blood, I'm always on the move.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.